Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 111 of Season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is J-Bam, John, from the Dirty Harry Minute. Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
It's always a pleasure having you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back after a bit of an absence.
Just one season. You were here two seasons ago. You were on Die Hard 2, weren't you? I'm pretty sure you were. Yeah,
yes.
There you go. So it's not that much of an absence. I wouldn't complain about that.
No. Thank you.
All right. So minute 111 begins with Zeus cackling and ends with Zeus getting a little concerned, maybe even scared. You know, one or the other. Not 100% sure. You know, we'll have to explore that a little bit. When we get to the end of this minute, just to see what we really think about that. You know, is he scared? Is he just concerned?
I love your choice of word cackle, because I just listened to the minutes 111 from the start, and I'm like, it almost sounded like a bit of a villainous laughter, like that one and a half seconds you hear from Samuel L. Yeah, quite a good little quite a funny laugh.
Yeah, do you think this was like an audition for him to be a villain in the future?
Yes, very much.
Because we do have movies where he's the villain.
Seem to remember in Jurassic Park one of the scenes before Wayne Newton, what's his name? Before the bad guy leaves with the DNA, he has a laugh there as well. But it's been many years since I've actually seen Jurassic Park. But yeah, it's a good audition for.
Wait, which bad man? You're talking about no, not Wayne Newton. That's this Wayne.
Wayne Knight.
That's his name. Yeah. Wayne Knight. Yeah. Wayne Newton is someone else.
Yes, that singer from
Wayne Newton is a James Bond pseudo villain.
Who am I thinking of? Who am I thinking of? The sort of country singer from the '70s.
No, that's Wayne Newton. Oh, wow. It is Wayne Newton. But he's in James Bond, License to Kill. He plays, minister of a parish, you know, trying to get money by also possibly being a little too friendly to, one of the Bond girls. To Carrie, what's her name? Carrie. Oh, damn. It was Richard Gere's wife. Or might still be Richard Gere's wife.
I don't remember any Carrie's apart from Carrie that come to mind, but not him.
No. Well, you can also think of Carrie Elwes, but it's not him. It's Carrie Lowell. That was her name. That is her name. Carrie Lowell. Right. She was in she played a Bond girl in License to Kill, and she was also on Law and Order. For many years, she was on like 50 episodes as Jamie Ross, and she also played Tom Hanks' deceased wife in Sleepers in Seattle.
Okay,
I always had a crush on her.
Yeah. Sorry for that tangent, Rob.
So that's how I know who it is. You know, what's wrong with the tangent? There's no problems with tangents. It's okay. So she was married to Richard Gere from 2002 to 2016, and they got divorced in 2016. So you see, she's available, but I'm not. So, well, I guess she'll just have to, she'll just have to bin and bear it, grin and bear it, I guess.
Richard Gere's a bit of a blind spot in my film watching pastime. I think the last thing I remember seeing him in was the Dylan biopic. You know, that Todd Haynes one? I'm still there. No, I'm not there. Yeah, he was good in that, his little part. He's sort of like the 80s George Clooney.
I mean, you know that he has
in terms of sex appeal and
yes,
sort of stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But he also has a connection to Die Hard.
Oh.
He was the original choice to play John McClane.
Oh, really?
In the original Die Hard. Yes.
I reckon that would have sucked.
But he turned it down for some.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. I mean, come on, nobody could play this role like Bruce Willis does. You know, that's one of the ironies of the Die Hard franchise, you know, and Bruce Willis's career. You know, they gave it to him after like 20 people didn't, turn down the role, and nobody thought that it would work. And they were able to create a whole new genre for movies, and they propelled Bruce Willis's career. I mean, he was constantly in movies like this for, you know, for the last almost 40 years. You know, and unfortunately, you know, that's more or less come to an end because of his health situation. But, you know, the fact that he was able to do this is just amazing.
Yeah, no, he's tremendous. And
so, yeah, so this cackle by Zeus is, it really is, it, like I said, it sounds to me like an audition for a villainous role, which will come up at some point in the future for him, you know, and he did it. I mean, we'll talk on Wednesday about Samuel L. Jackson's performances, but he was great as a villain also. I mean, he's great in a lot of things. So, you know, his range is just unbelievable.
100% agree. Even the in-between sort of roles where he's neither protagonist or hero, like even Unbreakable, I think he puts in a really good performance there. Just, I don't know if you've seen that movie, but spoiler alert, that's another favorite.
Obviously. Yeah, of course I've seen Unbreakable. What type of question is that? You think I haven't seen Unbreakable?
You are over 30.
I've seen Unbreakable.
He's really good in that, I believe. I think so.
Yes, yes. I've seen Unbreakable, yeah. And I love it. Yes.
Yeah. No, he's really, really good.
Yeah, but I think also it's funny how you said that he's there in the middle. I mean, he's not. I mean, again, you might talk more about this on Wednesday, but the idea is that you know, Mr. Glass, he's a villain, but you only find out, spoiler alert, at the end that he's the villain. But when you look back on it and you see everything that he did,
yep,
you can tell that you know, that he is, everything that he's doing
manipulative
is, yep,
that's
part,
right,
of the villain playbook.
But obviously you only know that in the last few minutes. Yep. And his role up to then has been one of, you think of a terrific actor. I don't think I've seen him in anything I haven't really liked on some level, and he always brings his A game. So yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, Samuel L. Jackson is an iconic actor, and you know, he only became iconic a year before this movie came out. And you know, history will talk about the, you know, these 30 plus years of Samuel L. Jackson for sure. You know, especially when dealing with movie history. And he ain't done yet.
One small criticism of him in this particular minute, in the first few seconds, he, like, I'm obviously a foreigner, I don't have an American accent, but he says marriage really quickly on the ADR, like marriage. I had to rewind that once. Is he talking about badge? That's badge or marriage? Marriage. Maybe it's just the New York accent.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
The American accent sometimes I don't pick up on. Yeah.
Well, you know, we know you Aussies do everything backwards. So, you know, you just, you know, rewind, rewind, rewind.
Marriage.
That's right.
Merge.
So Zeus then says to John, I mean, we ended things on Friday with Zeus basically saying to asking, the two of them are having a heart-to-heart as Zeus is trying to pick a lock, you know, pick the handcuffs of John's handcuffs that are, you know, that just, they're both tied to this this potential bomb. And then Zeus says to him, you threw away your marriage because you were too stupid to pick up the phone. And then he just continues to cackle. And John looks at him and goes, what, you think that's funny, huh? You laugh at other people's misfortunes? And then Zeus says, I bet you blame that wife too, right? And then John says, well, my wife is a very stubborn woman. Yes. And he goes, you better stop and undo these cuffs. So the phrase that came to mind when John makes that comment about the fact that Holly is supposed to be so stubborn, you know, there's two phrases that came to mind. The first one is, you know, the pot calling the kettle black.
Yes.
Have you heard that? Do they use that phrase in Australia?
We do. But it strikes my ears as being a bit old-fashioned. It's like something you'd read in Tintin, or maybe it's a bit more English or something. But, yeah, familiar with that expression. Yeah, pot calling the kettle black.
Right.
I bet you're going to tell us the origin and the timeline from when that comes.
That is what I'm going to do. How did you guess? How far back do you think that phrase goes?
Oh.
It's an idiom. How far back does that idiom go?
Yeah. Pot calling the kettle black. How long have there been kettles, I guess? I'm going to say medieval times, maybe 1500s or something, maybe Henry VIII. No idea.
No, it only goes back to the phrase itself only goes back to 1620. There was a translation of Don Quixote. And in the phrases, you are like what is said that the frying pan said to the kettle. I mean the original nice. Spanish. I'm not gonna try and read the Spanish, but the original Spanish translation should be said the pan to the pot, get out of their black eyes. You know, which obviously shows that it is the same thing, more or less. So they, you know, basically at that point it started being used in many different places. But the interesting thing is if you can go back even further with similar phrases. You know, there's a phrase from the ancient Greek that talks about the snake and the crab, which is pretty much the same thing, where the critic censures its own behavior in another. There was a drinking song during the late 6th century BCE. And basically, when you're dealing with Aesop's fables, there was a mother crab and its young, where the mother tells the child to walk straight and is asked in return to demonstrate how it's done. Oh. You know, from the same idea.
Yeah.
There is a story, there's an Aramaic story that dates back around 500 BC also. And it says, the bramble sent to the pomegranate tree saying, wherefore the multitude of thy thorns to him that touches thy fruit? The pomegranate tree answers and says to the bramble, thou art all thorns to him that touches thee. So you can also go back to the Talmud. The Talmud also has something that's similar, where it's, do not ascribe to your fellow your own blemish, which is pretty much the same thing.
Yes.
It's interesting that, you know, this is a common concept that has been around for, you know, thousands of years. You know, the idea that people can be hypocritical, or they don't see their own problems. And they, when they ascribe some sort of problem to someone else, it could be that they themselves suffer from the same exact problem, but we'll never see it.
Yeah. You've mentioned the Talmud there, obviously.
I like the way
Talmud there. Yeah, mm-hmm. Obviously in the New Testament, there's that parable about don't criticize the speck in someone's eye when you've got a log in your own, or I'm butchering the biblical, but a similar.
Something similar to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why John was attracted to his wife. He's a stubborn man, and she's a stubborn woman. They're made for each other, or maybe not.
Well, don't they say opposites attract?
That's right. For at least a few years.
Or is that only if you're Paula Abdul?
Nice. Yes.
Who knows?
It's good to know that Cervantes, though, you know, because they say Cervantes is the Spanish language's Shakespeare, and obviously Shakespeare's lent a lot of words to the English language, so it's good to see that Cervantes has done the same in Spanish and English. That's nice.
Yeah, it seems to work that way. You know, I mean, the other phrase that I was thinking of that's somewhat connected to it is the idea of the eye of the beholder.
Yes.
You know, I know that usually refers to beauty, but it could talk about anything. You know, the whole idea of someone's, you know, someone has their own opinion as to, you know, what they think of something. And it's the same way here. You know, that John is looking at the fact that Holly is stubborn, even though he doesn't realize that he himself is stubborn. He's, you know, from his perspective, she's the one who's stubborn. And probably from her perspective, he's the one who's stubborn. So, you know, it's something that works both ways.
Yeah, both things can be true.
Yes. All of the above, right?
Mm.
You know, Zeus continues with his lockpicking, and he goes, I'm almost there. And he goes, there. How's that for concentration? showing that he's able to have this conversation at the same time as he's picking a lock. And he goes, oh. And he goes, what? I dropped the thing. Drop the God damn it. Where is it? Where'd it go? Find it. Find it. All right. And then John like gets down and starts looking around for the splinter. We saw the splinter last week. It's not very small, but you know, when you're looking for it in a huge hull, like they're in, that something's going to take a little more time to do. It's not like finding a needle in a haystack, but it's still pretty interesting to have to try and find it.
Yep.
And then John goes, I don't f*** it. And what's great is as John says that, you know, we hear like a sound. And we see that the mechanism starts to you know, make noise and stuff like that, the mechanism for the bomb. Now, do you think John activated by touching it, or was it something that this was the time it was meant to go, so it just started, you know, randomly?
I've thought about that a little bit, and I'm not sure, but I'm tending towards John triggering it, maybe his weight or something when he's gone off. I don't know. What are you inclined to believe?
I always believed that this was the time that it was meant to go, but watching it now, doing my research, I had more of a feeling that it's the idea that you know, the system, I guess, felt that something is in the process of trying to tamper with it, so therefore it activates. That's what I think.
Yeah. The weight, maybe.
Yeah, no, just the fact that someone touches it, you know. Even though, yeah. I mean, John and Zeus are sitting on top of it, but I guess if you get close enough to the, to where the actual mechanism is, maybe that's part of it.
John and Zeus hadn't interrupted their plans, were they just going to put a time delay on it for them to scoot away to Canada? I wonder how they would have just set a delay then.
Yeah, well, obviously he said a delay.
Yeah. But I wonder if it would have been just 10 minutes after they've cleared the boat or half an hour later or... But, yeah.
My assumption is it wouldn't have been that long because, you know, Simon didn't want someone else to get a hold of it.
That's
right.
You know,
that's the type of thing. He would want, okay, we know that everything's good. Let's get out of here before the Coast Guard shows up or somebody shows up, you know, and then just blow up the ship as quickly as possible. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
Right. And then Zeus hears the fact that the mechanism starts doing it. Because remember, he's still sitting on top, handcuffed. And he goes, what the f*** is that? And John says, I think I made it mad. And he goes, just go, McLean. Get the f*** out of here. And then you see John like rummaging around and he goes, I can do something. And he goes, God damn it, McLean, listen to me. Just go. And he goes, I had a hard time. He says, I have a hard enough time getting through the day without having your death on my conscience, man. He goes, shut the fuck up and think, all right, okay. Tools, check the engine room. There's no time. What the hell is it doing now? And at that point, we start hearing the sound of the mixture mixing together, and he goes, it's mixing. And then we get a shot of Zeus's face, and then he goes, oh, and you know, we can tell at that point that Zeus is quite concerned at this point, even though he just moments ago was telling John, okay, get out of here and let me die.
Yeah,
that type of thing. So, I mean, I like the fact that he is resolved to the fact that he's willing to be a hero. You know, even though we don't need him to be a hero, we don't want him to be a hero, but, you know, he's resolved that maybe if that's what's going to happen, okay, I'm willing to deal with it. Which says a lot about Zeus also. You know, that here he's willing to do something for the greater good and save John, even though, you know, the two of them are... interestingly, becoming closer friends, you know, through the course of this fun day.
I can't help but feel that though that word must have been said in so many movies before. Just go. Like where someone's tied up and they realize there's no hope. Can you think of any up the top of your head?
Off the top of my head,
side
wow.
Adventure.
There's
no, just
tons of
those
them.
Situations where there's two people, one can One person, yeah. Well, I think 90s action movies. This isn't a trick question, by the way. I was just thinking, it just sounded so like, there must be a really obvious example I'm not thinking of, but you just go and like,
How about Titanic?
But anyway,
yeah. Titanic. Yeah,
that's right.
There we go.
Yeah.
We both said it at the same time. Titanic.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. It's funny that we both, you know, the two big examples that you brought, including this one, it's all things that take place on a boat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Just go, McLean. Does he say McLean? I can't remember. Or just go. Very good. But as you say, he's willing to be a hero, but then he finds out from McLean his demise will really take place actually a lot sooner than he thought, and then it's suddenly shit.
That's right.
But yeah. Can we go back to the line, "I think I made it mad"?
Yes.
That's such a great line. It's like something you could use it in many situations, not just life and death ones, you know, getting someone angry with you, you know. He really could have savored that line if he was a different sort of actor. Like, I think, like in a really 90s comedy where like, I think I made it mad, like in a really bad TV show. But he just offhand says it really quickly, and it's delivers it in that great Bruce Willis style.
Right. I mean, part of the thing here is the fact that it gives the mechanism or the bomb itself it makes it a character by saying I made it mad, you know, that type of thing.
Yes.
As opposed to being an inanimate object, it gives. That's right. It animates the object.
Nice. I don't know if you talked about this in previous minutes, Rob, but the cinematography on these minutes anyway is so good. Like, you've got these reds and yellows and I guess you'd say light aquas or light greens, and it's just the set is lit so well. Probably wouldn't have noticed that years ago on DVD or on TV, but it's really well filmed. I really like this stretch of the whole movie, really. It's quite good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they do a nice job. And I mean, we talked a little bit about it last week, but the way that they do this conversation between the two of them is just filmed amazingly.
Yeah,
because of the camera movements and the way that they do it. I really like that also.
And you obviously talked about Bruce Willis being tied up in Pulp Fiction. I suppose that's been talked about.
No, actually, it's never come up. It has not come up throughout this entire movie.
Who do you like? Mr. Wallace or Zeus? Both very.
It's actually funny that you mentioned this because I just watched Pulp Fiction again 2 days ago.
Topical for
yeah.
you.
Which one do I like better?
Who would you rather be tied up with?
Very good question.
Zeus
because
or Mr. Wallace. Well, maybe too obvious question, I guess, Zeus. But
no, because it's not an obvious question. Because if you want to talk about it, I mean, here, you know, John needs Zeus's help in order to get out. Okay, in Pulp Fiction, Butch is able to get out on his own.
Yeah.
And then he has to decide whether to save Marcellus Wallace or not. Here, he chooses right away to save Zeus. So it's an interesting way to look at it. I never thought about it this way before. So which situation I think is better? I got to tell you, as much as I love this movie and I love this scene, I think Butch's scene is better because you can really see the way that Butch has to decide what to do. Here, John has no qualms about it. He knows right away. Yeah. But with Butch, you know, you see on his face, you know, do I save him or do I just save myself? And then he's like, all right, I'm going to find a way to save Marcellus Wallace. Not because he thinks that Marcellus is going to, you know, pay him back properly, for saving him, but he just knows that it's the right thing to do. So I think that's the way I look at it from that perspective. What would you think? Which of the two do you think is a better?
You gave my answer as a textbook. Great answer. Yes. No, definitely rather that situation.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. What do you think?
Okay. I have nothing else to talk about in this minute. Do you have anything else?
No. I just thought for any red-hearted American, they'd probably like to see in the background that it says the pipes were made in USA. So that's always a cool thing.
Right. Yes. We talked about that on Friday. I wasn't able to understand what it said. I thought it was like gibberish. But my guest, you know, was able to explain to me what it said.
I briefly thought it said made by the IRA.
Oh, that would have been even funnier.
The only thing I noted else about this scene was how movie injuries appear. Cuts always look like they've already developed scabs in movies. Like it looks like they're sort of a few hours old, whereas it's probably just half a minute, don't you think? To give that cinematic look.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more later in the week about... Right, we'll talk a little bit more later in the week about injuries in movies and how those affect people or not.
Yes.
All right.
That's
so,
all I had.
Okay, great. There's nothing to talk about with the script because this is not in the script, you know, this entire segment of the movie. So every Monday we have a segment called McTiernan Monday, where my guests will give their top five John McTiernan films. So... why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
Number five is Hunt for Red October. Or until just recently, I was always calling it The Hunt for the Red October. Great movie. It's been a while. I'm definitely due a review of that. But from memory, it's really good. Very tense. Good action scenes. The models and everything quite good. But I've got to rewatch it. Number four. This was really hard. It was a tie-up between Die Hard 3, or this movie, and Predator, but I said Predator, number four. Number three, ultimately, Die Hard with a Vengeance. Number two, I don't know if this will be controversial or not, but Last Action Hero, because I effing love that movie. Always have. I know it's got its haters. They thought it's trying to be too meta at a time when, you know, we still love our Van Dams and our Schwarzeneggers and our Stallones, but I really think it's actually quite smart and funny and enjoyable as an action film. I'll fight you, man, because Last Action Hero is really good, and I'm sick of people giving it beep. Anyway, and of course, number one, guess what it's going to be?
Medicine Man.
That Connery thing?
Yeah.
I've never seen it. Die Hard.
You're not missing anything.
Easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Understandable.
Ah, good.
Right. All right. Excellent. So, John, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Yes. A few years ago, I finished my podcast called Dirty Harry Minute. Guess what we reviewed? You can still find it at dirtyharryminute.com, you know, Spotify, Stitcher, all those places, iTunes. We're finished up, but we do periodic, yearly or biannual episodes when we have time and it takes our fancy. Dirty Harry Minute, please. Go there.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, mother.
Marching home again, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hurrah! Hurrah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.